Well, we have entered into a new season. Now, I know spring's been here for a little bit, but it just feels like spring now. We have fresh air, we have rainy days, and the ever-important increasing sunlight. The cherry blossoms are out, gardens are beginning to flourish everywhere. I love this season. It embodies this wonderful shift from cold and dark to warm and growth. I hope that this can also be a signal for us as a church. It's time to grow. It's time to look inward and outward and ask Jesus, give us the opportunities that we need to develop, that we need in order to grow, that we need in order to flourish. Today we're returning to our series on Mark, and we find ourselves deep into chapter 12, verses 38 to 44, and Jesus is in the temple. This is the heart of Judaism. This is the seat of power. This is the place where identity is formed. It's the place where culture is set. And after Jesus, in the previous passages, just to remind you, after Jesus dealt with all the tricky questions from the lawyers and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all the rest of those kind of leaders, we see Jesus enter into this intense time of teaching. Jesus now calls those around him, the people, the disciples, the crowds, he calls them to embrace a life that is modeled by him, a life that calls you to put people first, to put people at the center. That's our first key point. Jesus asks us to put people at the center. And today we're looking at a toxic culture that doesn't put people at the center. It devours them. Have you ever been a part of a workplace or a team that hasn't been a very supportive or healthy community? I asked that question before, and I'll ask it again, and I know that this immediately connects with you because we've all been there. But the real oddity, the unique question is to ask, have you ever been a part of a supportive community? Have you ever been a part of a community that encouraged your flourishing, that made you feel better about who you are, and helped you to become more than what you are right now? When I was 16, I went to a camp called Furwood. It's down in Bellingham, and I was a CIT, that's a counselor in training. Now, if you've never been to a camp before, they run on a pretty bare bones budget. So their big strategy is to hire teenagers at really low income levels and to basically take care of the maintenance, all the running of programs, and to do all of like the groundwork at the camp. That's what I was. I was a CIT. My job was to clean, help cook, help prepare and run games, and to watch kids. Now, I did not want to do this. When I was given the opportunity to go to camp, I first said no because I had had a bad experience the previous year as a camper. In grade 10, I went to camp, and it was the worst 2 weeks of my life. First off, a cabin is comprised of 8 boys and one camp counselor who's probably, 18 to 20, around that age, very mature, super wise. And And in iCabin, we were like the misfit cabin. We had a guy there who was at camp doing community service because he had basically been caught doing arson at school, had lit a bunch of garbage cans on fire, and he was working off his community debt at camp. So he was in our cabin. And he's the one who set our cabin culture. He would push boundaries. He would make jokes. He would do things that made us uncomfortable. But he was kind of scary. We were really worried and didn't want him to turn his attention to us. So whenever somebody started getting bullied or teased, we stayed quiet because we knew that if we spoke up, he would just latch on to us. That 2 weeks was terrible. So when I was asked if I would come back to camp and be a CIT, I did not want to do it. But because of some good peer pressure, I ended up going. And this was 2.5 months of life-changing community. This was a place where I was in a structure that was based around making us flourish as people, giving us responsibility, and coaching and helping us carry it out. Going from the year previously, where it felt like a camp experience from hell, to a real life-giving experience that left me feeling like a better person and able to enter back into my own social group back home with a confidence and character that helped shape my own life and social culture from then on. I look back at my time as a CIT and I go, that's an example of a life-giving community. When we experience that kind of community, we need to hold on to it. We need to encourage it. We need to help it grow. And most of all, we need to share it. Not all workplaces, churches, communities, schools are like this. And the temple culture in Israel at the time of Jesus was definitely not like this. Mark 12, 38 begins with Jesus sitting in the temple. And the last time we heard from Jesus, he made some pretty shocking claims saying that he was greater than David. Now, if you're an Israelite and you're thinking, what was the best time in Israel's history? You look back and you think of like David. That's the best. You know, if we're talking about good culture, good community culture, David's time was the good community culture. And Jesus comes up and he says, I'm better than that. That would have been very shocking. The crowds didn't pick up stones and try to kill Jesus. They were delighted. And they're probably delighted because they look around them and they see a culture that is devastating. Starting in verse 38, we see Jesus observing what's going on. As he taught, Jesus said, "Watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely." Jesus surveys the temple and sees nothing but corruption, a completely toxic temple culture. We're no strangers to this scene, and we love putting this kind of idea into teen movies. Have you ever seen a teen movie? You know that it starts off with a new kid coming to school. They show up and they get toured around the lunchroom and they get shown all the different cliques and the hierarchy of the school. Well, this is what Jesus ends up doing in the temple. He walks into the temple and he sees the Pharisees over here and he sees the Sadducees over there and he sees the lawyers over this way. And he sees a trope that shouldn't be a trope. We shouldn't have this sort of dynamic. And of all the places, the temple is the one that shouldn't have this type of toxic culture. We probably don't feel that as much as we should, because when we think of a temple, we think of a place that you go and you worship. Maybe you sacrifice animals, and maybe there's prayers. We think of it of ceremony and of like rules, but a temple isn't ceremony and rules. The temple is a place that tells a story. Now, if you were to look back in your Old Testament, you read all the passages on the temple and the creation of the temple, you'd see that the temple is a microcosm of what Eden was like. The Garden of Eden was a perfect place. Everything was as it should be. And the temple took that idea and put it into its very walls and structures. The temple was supposed to be a Garden of Eden. Perfect. This was far from it. This was not a perfect place. And the scariest part of this text is Jesus' pronouncement at the end of it, at the end of the section we read. The worst punishments are left for these. Chilling. We love Jesus as a teacher. We love Jesus as a friend. We love these images of Jesus as somebody who brings healing. But this is one that is uncomfortable. And it is rightly uncomfortable because often it is pointed at us, the people who come to church, the ones who set the culture. It's a deep realization to see the Bible not judging outward, but judging inward. Now, we look at this lifestyle we see, and it kind of reminds me of Psalm 73. Psalm 73 says, "But as for me, my feet had almost slipped. I had nearly lost my foothold, for I envied the arrogant. When I saw the prosperity of the wicked, they have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They are free from common human burdens. They are not plagued by human ills. Therefore, pride is their necklace, and they clothe themselves in violence." Psalm 73 looks at a wicked and toxic culture, a toxic culture based on amassing wealth, and views its apparent success. This toxic culture looks like it works. When Jesus looks in the temple and sees this terrible dynamic, it doesn't mention that the other people in the temple probably look around and see this dynamic and wish they were that person. I wish I had the honors. I wish I had the money. I wish I had the privilege, the position. If only I could be them. Last week, I read an article in the New York Times that a friend posted on Facebook. It was about this Matt Gaetz sex scandal going on. And this Republican congressman has had a known reputation, a reputation for sharing lewd photos with his fellow congresspeople and bragging about his sexual conquests. This article asked the question, how and why do we end up with a toxic locker room culture? And she nails it. After saying that people should never show nude pictures, the author of this article says this. Speaking to the person showing the pictures, she says, "But if you can't stop yourself from showing nude pictures, then ideally it would only happen once. It happens only once because the moment you do it, the person you show it to responds the way a person should respond. You produce your photograph to your colleague, and your colleague looks at it at you and says, 'Never show that to anyone ever again. Go home and rethink your life. I do not feel closer to you.'" A toxic culture develops because we let it. When someone makes an uncomfortable joke, we let it slide. We don't make it clear that something is out of bounds, out of boundary. When somebody shows a picture that crosses the line, we don't say stop. I think, too, that when we look at this passage, it should remind us that our culture is shaped by the things that we prize and value, and that should really disturb us. Somewhere deep inside, maybe we don't speak up, either because we're afraid. That can be the case. But sometimes we don't speak up because secretly we wish we were that person. In Israel, honor, wealth, position, these were the recipe of a toxic culture. And these were things that people wanted. And so when these lawyers in this passage were seen devouring widows' homes, taking away their ability to survive in this world, they didn't speak up because probably, secretly, they wished that they had the power and finances and the position to do that themselves. Psalm 73 ends like this: "When I tried to understand all this, it troubled me deeply. Till I entered the sanctuary of God, then I understood their final destiny. Surely you place them on slippery ground. You cast them down to ruin. How suddenly are they destroyed, completely swept away by terrors." The psalmist pulls back from their observation that they, when they see this wicked, toxic culture, and after building up this seemingly unfair position that the wicked get everything they want, the psalmist brings down the hammer. And why do they do that? The psalmist does that because they look at the temple. The temple, this structure that's supposed to be the place that shows you how the world ought to be. The Garden of Eden. They look at the Garden of Eden and they say, "The wicked will not prosper." When Jesus looks at the temple, he doesn't see that. He sees a tragedy. But in Jesus' day, the temple was a place of violence. Now, this sort of idea of violence, it's not kind of like punching someone or that kind of overt physical violence. It's the violence that comes from this toxic culture. The violence that takes and destroys people. And the irony of this is Jesus puts prayer and violence together in this passage. These lawyers devour widows and then pray elegant and beautiful prayers. The image is violent because violence is bred into this temple. The Garden of Eden, this place of perfection, it's not supposed to be violent. And then the very next thing in the following passage, in the following verses, Jesus sees a widow, the very kind of person that we just heard about getting victimized, a person who's invisible. Jesus continues. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small coins, worth only a few cents. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, and put everything in, all she had to live on." She had two coins. That's almost equivalent to putting nothing in the offering. Today, a penny is worthless. It has no monetary value. And basically what she put into the offering was that. It's the equivalent of just putting lint into the box. Jesus sees this. Jesus sees her. Let's pause for a minute. This is a person who is invisible. In the previous section, we just heard that Jesus talks about the lavish displays of honor and grace and poise. These are things that are supposed to catch your attention. These are people that draw your focus. And quietly, in the background, a widow comes in. Someone who has no honor, no position, is the least in this setting. And Jesus sees her. Some of us today feel like the least. Some of us today are the least. You might feel invisible, but Jesus sees you. And Jesus looks at you and says, "You are in this kingdom. You're in this family." And in this passage, not only is the widow in this family, she sets the example. She's the one who should stand out. The one whose example we follow. And it's a challenging example to follow. She put in everything. Even when the temple was a place of a toxic culture. Even when the temple worked against her, she still brought everything. Discipleship will cost you everything. And while this is about money, and money hits us in the pocketbook, and we all know that our pocketbook is what hurts the most, it's also more, it's about more than just money. We are called to put everything, all of who we are, into this offering. This is no accident, because if you want to change a culture, even if it's just your social group, you got to put a lot in there. It takes more than just speaking up. It takes more than just avoiding. And it takes more than just acting on your own conscience. It's going to take everything you have to shift a culture. But it's possible. And when we see these examples from Matt Gaetz, this nasty participation in a culture that is abusive and terribly destructive, we have to remember that if we want to shift this kind of thing, it's going to take us putting everything in. The early church followed the example of this widow. The early church didn't hold anything back. they went and shared a gospel in a culture that thought that they were eating babies. We don't like it when people think we're pushy or judgmental, you know, and I feel that condemnation. I go, oh, you know, like, I don't want to come across that way. And that sometimes silences me from speaking up or sharing what I think that God's putting on my heart. But in the early church, people thought they ate babies and they still spoke up. If they can do that, surely we can put up a bit of the, put up with the tension that comes with maybe coming across as impolite. The early church followed the widow's example and they shifted culture. They shifted a culture that we look back on and condemn, the Roman culture. We look back on that and we go, that is probably like one of the worst and most disgusting empires that has had a rule for so long. And Christianity, that shifted it. Now, culture is always shifting. It's always moving back and forth. And in Christianity, we've had our own seasons of devouring widows. The church is not perfect. We'll never say that. But what we will say is this, is that we believe we're called to put it all in, to bring flourishing to community, and to bring about a life-giving faith that actually means something and changes things. Success, power, privilege, and wealth, those for me are not things that have particularly drawn my attention. But for me, personally, it's always been this idea of being smart, of being intelligent. This, for me, has been my own push towards that kind of toxic culture. A push towards trying to elevate and pursue something that does not follow the example of the widow. Now, we all have these things. Perhaps you have your own. I ask you to think of it and to think of why and how you've come to this place. And for me, it's because I'm dyslexic. Growing up with a learning disability is tough. It means that you constantly have this chip on your shoulder that you don't quite fit, that you always miss the mark. I always wanted to get really good grades and have like the best ideas. I wanted to feel like I was secure and secure in myself. But chasing after intelligence led me down the same track that we saw the lawyers in this passage. It led me to toxic values that not only hurt me, but hurt those around me. A story that I can tell and I feel very embarrassed about. But I was a youth leader, and I remember getting into a conversation with one of the youth about raising kids, and he said to me, I read an article in Parent Magazine that said that you should parent your child this way. And I said, oh, okay, well, I don't do that. And he's like, well, this person, this article has a PhD. And I said, well, there's lots of people out there with PhDs that are really dumb. And then, you know, immediately I'm like, I am getting into a silly argument with a kid because he's making me feel stupid. And I'm realizing that I'm trying to take a chunk out of this person because it's touching a nerve in me, a toxic value that I have. Now, school, having good answers, having being intelligent, these aren't bad things. But they become bad when we place them too high and when we allow them to be the shapers of who we are. We are called to be shaped by Jesus. And Jesus is putting on your heart what he's calling you to do. And I ask you to listen. to embrace that, because when we connect with what Jesus is calling us to, things change. And this is a world that needs change. I ask you to pray with me. Lord, we thank you so much that you're a God that cares and loves us, that you've called us to put people first and to bring this world the message of the gospel. Lord, as we prepare our hearts to hear the last song, I ask that you would embrace us and give us the power and the courage to face the tough social situations we see in the we see in our everyday lives. We thank you that you have given us Jesus as the example, and we thank you that Jesus is the one who can see those who are invisible and call us to a better way. And I pray, Lord, that we'd go into this week following that better way. Amen.